You don't dare go before he counsels here, though. Don't you?
The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to our order. We let the record reflect that we have a quorum. The first bill on the agenda is Senate File 1525. Senator Laurie.
You don't have counsel here, though. Okay.
Counsel will hear that we've started and they'll come.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 1525, I know I've talked with many of you about it already. This is a MSOP data practices, data access proposal. It does two things, really. Section 1 allows the responsible authority to have a designee or the DHS data practices compliance official respond to MSOP patient challenges as to what is in their MSOP medical record. This is really pretty standard practice right now. The responsible authority is the commissioner, and of course they need to delegate the initial review of these things to staff, and patients do still have a appeal process available to them and whatnot. So this is really more of a technical change. Section 2 provides a limited number of MSOP staff access to the statewide supervision system maintained by the Minnesota Department of Corrections regarding individuals' criminal background and how they worked with the Department of Corrections in their corrections time. And this would help MSOP with intake, make sure that they assess the individual properly and get them in the right place in treatment. It would also help them during the treatment process understand the nature of the history that we're trying to treat, and then also as we try to build the intensive community supervision piece of the program that is going to be a critical piece as we move forward, it'll help to make sure that we have comprehensive information on the client to make sure that that goes as well as it can. I've got a couple of members from MSOP here to give a little bit more detail and answer questions when we from the committee.
Madam Chair, members,
for the record, welcome to the committee.
I'm Dan Storkamp, the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Let me just quickly go through a couple key things here on Section 1. The responsible authority, this is something the agency is doing because of the large number of requests from patients to look at or challenge the records that go into or the data that goes into their record. This is a step that we want to take to speed up that process. And the director of IPAD is here, Lori Barakopensky. They've reviewed and support the section. Matter of fact, I think they've got a small technical amendment to that section they'd like to make.
Barakopensky, do we have the amendment?
Madam Chair and members, Senate Counsel and I spoke about it. I don't know if you have the amendment or not, but what it would be is at line 1.16, after responsible authority, you would be inserting comma, designee, or data practices compliance official, just as you have on lines 1.10 and 1.11.
Okay. Senator Olson moves that oral amendment. Any discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Ms. Barakopensky, what is the difference between, I thought there was a responsible authority, and then sometimes you may say, or they're a designee. Isn't a data practices compliance official also a designee?
Madam Chair and members, the statute actually doesn't say you have to have designees. You can, but the statute does provide that every responsible authority has to name a data practices compliance official, too. So you can have multiple designees, but you have to have one responsible authority and one data practices compliance official. And sometimes the responsible authority and the data practices compliance official are the same person.
Okay. Ms. Storkamp, Section 2.
Madam Chair and members, Section 2 is requesting limited access to a few MSOP staff to the statewide supervision system. The statewide supervision system is an enhanced pointer system. It gives us basic information about probation, jail, and prison information, as well as some programming information and, real important, key contact information to follow up and get more information. The Minnesota Sex Offender Program goes through a whole process of fact-finding from the time the court lets us know that individuals are going to be coming to us through admission. And there's actually four areas that the program is needing this information. The first is that admission. Prior to the person coming to us, we're finding as much facts around this individual as possible to help us understand any safety, security, and assessment needs prior to that person arriving. At times, we may get the 15-page short summary from the courts, and other times, we don't get this till after they actually arrive. So it's a public safety issue, just ensuring that we've got that information available to us at the time that they arrive. Secondly is when we start doing our assessments. We need to know a complete history, a factual history of where this individual was, at what points in the process, because that really helps us develop the best treatment plan available for these individuals. The third point is during the safety and security. There are times when our population have been assaultive, and they've had a history of assaultive behavior in jail and prison prior to being committed to the sex offender program. That information is real critical and helpful for us when we start developing plans on how to deal with safety and security in our facilities. And finally, as we've got two individuals that have now are outside of our secure environment in the Community Preparation Services program, the next phase for them is the conditional or provisional discharge, which gets them into the community under supervision. This system would be really beneficial to understand where they've been under supervision before so that we can then get that information to help put together the best supervision reintegration plan for that patient to ensure that patient's safety and security as well as the communities is protected during that process. What we're asking for here is that we get information for assessments, treatment plans, as well as supervision reintegration, and it really is for a limited number. We're not looking for everybody in MSOP, but the key people that would need it to help do their jobs. This is to improve the efficiencies of the program, Madam Chair, members.
So, Mrs. Storkamp, how are you going to manage the access to this information?
Madam Chair and members, that's actually an excellent question. We have worked with the Department of Corrections. We will be putting a policy in place that specifically says who and how they get access, and the Department of Corrections will be doing audits of our individuals that are accessing the system to ensure that they're accessing only those that are Minnesota sex offender patients and that they're only using it for the appropriate person or appropriate activities as outlined in the statute here.
Mrs. Storkamp, are you aware if the database system is such that it is only accessible by are there different levels of data that could be designated to be accessed by particular types of passwords?
Madam Chair and members, I think that they do have some, but I don't think it's comprehensive that certain areas can be shut off or turned on. I'm not fully up to speed in what Department of Corrections got available in that.
Is there anybody from Corrections here who could talk to us a little bit about access to that database? Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, I've heard a representation that they're going to develop some policies to limit the access and audit it. I don't see the language in the bill that says that, you know, so we're just accepting their representation that's going to be done. I'd feel a lot more comfortable if that's their plan, that we actually put that in the bill, that they must develop some policies on, you know, limited access and the fact that it's going to be audited so that we make sure that it's actually going to be done. Because the way I read, you know, this bill right now, it's virtually anybody who works for the sex offender program can have access to anybody at any time. And, you know, that's not what the testimony I heard. I heard that there's a limited number of people going to have access to it, and it's only going to be a limited number of people. But that isn't what the bill says.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, I just also like to thank Senator Lori for having several long conversations with me about this bill. I'm very cognizant of the concern and the public safety issues, which I think are very legitimate. And I guess I would also say that I don't think this is a population that I'm, you know, it's easy to do things because of the nature of this population without perhaps maybe thinking through the whole thing from a legal standpoint. But from my perspective, at least in putting this in context, I first had to discover that if someone with another type of a mental health commitment did not want their records to be transferred. They could not be without that person's authorization. And so I am just a little concerned about the possible consequences of blurring that line. I'm also, I guess I would just say that I would hope that no one would be considered for a provisional discharge unless they had at least shown the level of cooperation that would be necessary to give consent to get their records. If a person's still hiding information and they've been that level of dangerous sex offender, I would hope we're not considering discharging them. So I just wanted to make a point of pointing that out. I'm not comfortable with this.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Senator Laurie?
I guess I'll respond to both Senator Betzold and Senator Olson, and I do think that Senator Betzold brings up some excellent points, and we would consider friendly amendments, ones that listed the limitations that is the intent of this legislation and that put in a requirement for audit. And so maybe we can get some help with Senate Counsel to get those drafted quickly. I would hope that would be able to be done. And I'm also sensitive, and as Senator Olson indicated, we've had several long discussions about this, she brings up some really valid points, and I'm happy to be sensitive to those, but do think that the ability to gain access to this data, and it's not really even just a waiver that the client gives. It's really the format of the data is also in question. I mean, a client can say, yes, you can have access to my data, but it doesn't give you access to the statewide supervision system, which is one that is familiar to people and is a complete source. So even if they give a waiver under the current system and we gain access, it's not necessarily the same, and you have to go through all different channels to get it from different sources. I mean, the statewide supervision system has already built that comprehensive access to data that includes data from other states and is a really comprehensive source that I think it would be really wise to make sure that the appropriate people, and again, we'll work with an amendment and consider it a friendly amendment to make sure that it is just those appropriate people within MSOP for the treatment and the assessment and the discharge planning purposes. So I don't know if anybody...
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, I was listening to what Senator Betzold said earlier and the witnesses. I mean, perhaps this on page 2, line 24, after the period, insert, the program shall develop a policy to specify who shall have access to the data and for what purposes. The Commissioner of Corrections shall conduct periodic audits to determine whether the policy is being followed.
Senator Laurie?
We've already specified the purposes, so I mean, I would limit it to that. I mean, it seems like that might give them broader, you know, I'd like to narrow it down to the purposes already specified. I think that it could be stronger in that regard to limit MSOP to those purposes already specified. I don't know, maybe.
Well,
and
also, Mr. Backus, they've indicated that this is only going to apply to a limited number of individuals, so I think the directive ought to identify just who it is they're talking about and not just everybody. So, you know, whatever criteria they come up with ought to indicate, you know, who's going to have access on, you know, which individuals are going to have access to, as well as the audit. So I think we've got a few more questions that, you know, Mr. Backus can have take his time and put this together. Madam Chair.
Senator Betzold.
I'll share a thought I had with Senator Laurie as we talked about it briefly yesterday, that I was the author of the civil commitment bill that passed in the special session in 1994 that in the response to the Linehan case that had changed the procedures for civil commitments of sex offenders. And when we passed that bill, I said this is going to be challenged in court. It's going to be, you know, and it's to this day it's being challenged, you know, on constitutional grounds for various reasons. So far, the courts have upheld the program. But I said then, I've said over the years, and I continue to say it, This is all supposed to be about treatment, treatment, treatment. That's the only reason we have to hold these individuals against their will and hold them in this type of a program. It's for treatment, treatment, treatment. And over the years, more and more and more, we've gone in the direction, little by little, and this bill may also be part of inching away, to say that, well, we're really incarcerating them because they're bad people, which is not, again, treatment. I don't know that we have this kind of access to patients who are mentally ill and dangerous. So at some point, I can easily see the courts saying we've gone too far. This whole program is unconstitutional. Let them go. And I don't know what that tipping point is going to be, but this is, you know, you can't keep locking people up saying we're treating them, but they're really criminals, and that's what it is, because we don't have any authority to just lock them up and throw away the key. And frankly, even the, you know, a couple of years ago when we had the, in response to the murder of Drew Shadeen, there was a lot of rhetoric around this building that I wouldn't be surprised if it shows up in some appellate briefs someday, showing that the intention of the legislature was really to lock them up and throw away the key, not treatment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, in your motion, one way to resolve that would be to have some kind of a penalty for improper access or improper use. That there clearly is not that in existence that I can see.
Madam Chair, I think there may be already. I guess we'd have to check with counsel on that, because I think there are, but I don't know what they are right now. It's my understanding. Ms. Pontius is sort of nodding here.
Ms. Pontius?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, I think they'd be subject to the general penalties under the Data Practices Act for violating the act, which can be either civil liability or, you know, willful violation is a misdemeanor.
Would that, Madam Chair, Ms. Pontius, and perhaps Mr. Backus may have to be part of this too. Would that be just, obviously, for people who wrongfully disclose the data, if somebody has access to the database and just starts looking stuff up when they really have no reason to go into the database, I don't know whether that's covered by data practices or some other law right now. I don't know. I thought it was, but I couldn't put my finger on it at this moment. So,
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
We've had numerous incidences of where people have gained access. I'm as much concerned about the access of the patient, if you will, in this case, so that his or her privacy data is protected, and that if another employee or other person violates that, it just seems to me that they should be penalized for that. And in statute, we often put things in without penalty, and we've noted that here in the last several weeks or so.
We have some people who might be able to give us information. Mr. Benson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dennis Benson, the executive director of this program. I want to respond to Senator Betzel, because I do think he raises valid concerns. I've only been there a year, but spent 34 years in corrections and kind of looked over the fence at this program. I would also just want to make clear that Mr. Storkamp was one of the creators of the statewide supervision system, so he has a great deal of knowledge with respect to what's in that system. But with respect to the program, a couple of things that I just want to make sure that this committee is up to date. We have made some very small progress, I believe, in the last 12 months in this program. Today we have two patients who have been placed on community preparation service, which is outside the fence. It's sort of the last stop before somebody would be considered by the court for provisional discharge. I, too, believe that the elephant in the room here is the fact that 12 years have passed, and only one person has been released, and he was shortly thereafter returned. We don't release people. We provide treatment. That's our charge, is to provide the very best treatment that we can. The courts are the decision makers with respect to release, courts in, courts out, and I know you all know that. I think those wheels are slowly starting to turn. The reason we're here today with this bill, our executive clinical director, Janine Hebert, is here as well, but so much has changed, and there's so much new information in just the last 5 years with respect to how we treat this kind of patient. And while they're not offenders, and they're not inmates, and they're not criminals, they are still untreated, very dangerous individuals. And we can't lose sight of that either. And as part of that effort to develop a treatment, an individualized treatment plan for each of these people, it's critical that we have all of the background information, absolutely critical, so that we can move forward with an appropriate treatment plan for the wide variety of personalities. We have people in this program that have a 60 IQ. We have others that have 133 IQ, very high psychopathy, and we have everything in between. So getting that background information on this population and being up to speed on any pending criminal activity. We just discovered recently that, not in our program, but another program in the system, there was a cold case that kind of bubbled to the surface. So I think things like that, having access to as much data as we can, and today, in the day of DNA testing, there can be new developments almost every day with a population like this. We do take a DNA from each of them. They go into a data bank, and I think it's critical that we stay current on any information that might surface with respect to that as well. But again, what's driving this discussion is really around the need to have complete information to develop the treatment plan.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess Senator Betzold's comments may be laid out in a more directly. A concern I maybe stated a little more obliquely, but what I'm wondering then, I guess, are two things, because the way your bill is written, if that's your purpose, it seems like we need to be clear and not just make it seem as though you're having exactly the same access as someone would have in corrections without those limitations. And I also think, again, I'll just state again, I would be very concerned to think that someone was being considered for release into the community if they hadn't given you consent to exactly the information that you're asking to have access to.
Ms. Barkopinski, can you shed some light on the data discussion?
Madam Chair and members, to Senator Betzel and Senator Olson's question, in addition to the civil and criminal penalties for violating the Data Practices Act, the rules provide that an employee who has access to private data should only get how much they need to do their work. And the rules also require the responsible authority, so in this case the Commissioner of Human Services, to develop procedures around who in their entity needs to have this to do their work. So it doesn't mean everyone. It may be more people than you'd think, but they need to have some procedures around who's going to get access to this system.
Although, Madam Chair, again, the language, and that's why we need the amendment, the language here would seem to supersede that, because it allows virtually anybody within the program to have virtually anything they want, and so they wouldn't have violated anything, unless it's amended. I guess the other question that I've got for Mr. Benson is that the point I made a minute ago is that we've got very dangerous people who have been civilly committed to the security hospital at St. Peter. Not all have criminal records. Many do not, but some do. Yet I don't see any proposal from the Department of Human Services for similar access to the data for that group. And again, if it's all treatment, more and more we're treating this group of sex offenders much differently than we treat other people who may be similarly situated. So I'm just pointing that out, that, you know, we're just keep going down that road that, you know, it's going to be kind of hard to justify that at some point.
Mrs. Storkamp, you have a lot of experience with the computerized, the statewide data system, and I see here that the data system contains both adult data and juvenile data.
No, I'm sure that's correct.
So I'm assuming that the access to the data that you want is to the entire statewide system, though. So you'll presumably be looking at both the adult and the juvenile data.
Madam Chair, that is correct. Specifically in the probation area, you get adult and juvenile information there. And then on the jail information, they have a limited number of juvenile facilities that provide information at this point.
So the current Minnesota sex offender clients, are any of them juveniles?
Madam Chair, they've been adjudicated as adults and when they're civilly committed, to my understanding.
Hmm. Maybe not today, but at a later point, I will be interested in what that population is. Maybe you could send a letter to the committee that we'll make available to the committee members.
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. Mr. Backus, you ready?
Yep. Madam Chair, it would be similar to what we had before, but it would be on page 2, line 24, after the period. Insert, the program shall develop a policy to allow individuals who conduct assessments, develop treatment plans, oversee security, or develop reintegration plans to have access to the data. The Commissioner of Corrections shall conduct periodic audits to determine whether the policy is being followed.
Mr. Storkamp participated in that discussion. Senator Betzel?
Yes, and also just a minor change on page 2, line 21. It says the program must have access. I think the word that we normally use would be shall. Okay, so I would also incorporate, I would move the amendment with also that technical change on page 2, line 21.
Senator Scheid, do you have a question? Or Senator Higgins? Well, Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, this is just additional language. You're leaving in place lines 21 through 24. Are you changing the must?
Mm-hmm. To a shall.
To shall.
Yeah. Madam Chair, this is way out of my area of expertise, but I have to say, if it's about treatment, and I think it is, then you got to have this stuff. I mean, how do you treat somebody without this information? It seems to me it's fundamental to treatment programs. So I think what Senator Betzel's amendment is just kind of elaborating on the fact that they should develop a policy, and I don't disagree with that. So you're not doing away with the access, but they have
yes.
to have a policy.
That's right.
And yeah. Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, the testimony we had at the start was the fact that they wanted a limited number of people to have access for a limited number of patients, and the language doesn't reflect that at all. It's wide open.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold's amendment is more than friendly.
Yes.
It is
yes.
very
good.
Helpful at getting exactly to what we're trying to get done. So
I
appreciate the committee's work on this.
On the Betzold oral
Madam
amendment,
Chair,
Senator Higgins.
There was, like the last sentence of the amendment was something about the Department of Corrections or the Commissioner of Corrections shall do something. Is that the right commissioner?
Mrs. Storkamp?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, Department of Corrections is the one we've been working with closely because it's their system, they're maintaining the system,
okay.
And they're the ones that did say that they will be doing and conducting audits on.
Okay.
Yes. On the Betzel oral amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Let me just add, at some point, I'm sure when the legislative auditor goes around and they make their reviews of various programs, they're probably also going to check to see how this database is being used.
Yes.
So there's going to be a couple of sets of eyes watching this, and you know, if this goes into effect, I sure expect that the people who are running this program make it absolutely clear that if you've got access to this database, it better be used for the intended purpose and nothing more.
Hmm. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lori.
I'm over at the MSOP program personally mm-hmm. with great frequency, and I will also inquire to the extent they can share with me. I will assist because you do bring up very, very valid points, and I take them very seriously and appreciate the help of the committee.
All right. Is there anybody here who would like to testify against this bill? Seeing none, there being no further discussion, Senator Scheid moves that Senate File 1525 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor, correct?
I've received no other requests.
Madam Chair? Madam Chair,
Senator Limmer?
I think Senator Betzold is correct in limiting this and then giving fair warning. Our problem always is after you and I are gone from this place and there's someone else sitting in all of our chairs, are they going to remember to be as strict about this access to information as we would like to be? And so that's always the dilemma when we write these types of openings to the wall of privacy. We're very concerned about that, and it'll just demand, you know, the old phrase, eternal vigilance. And so I think it's the appropriate thing to do, but you got to keep the theme going. The younger senators have to keep this theme and concern going and carry it with them after some of us old guys are gone. So.
On the Scheid motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank
you, Senator Betzel, this is another Senator Lori bill where he could not find any other co-authors.
Oh. He's
Senator Rest?
I never have co-authors either.
But there's a reason for that.
Well, I think your bill, Senator Betzel, I don't know if it's a bill or if it's the chief author.
Well,
they're so confident in your ability to get it through by yourself.
Madam Chair, I don't take rejection well, so when I when I shop my bills around and people say I'm not going to put name in, I just introduce them without co-authors. I can deal with it. And apparently, Senator Laurie has learned the same thing. So,
Senator Rest, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 1464. Is a proposal that adds a section to the statutes dealing with use of the space in the Capitol complex and buildings that are under the Department of Administration. And it allows for employees to use space in the buildings for wellness activities. And the reason for it is that this past summer, when employees on their own time, not during work time, sought to get together over in the state office building in some unused space under the leadership of actually Senator Ortman's L.A., to do some yoga exercises, that they found that the statutes didn't allow them to do that. And so so this bill is proposed to allow the entities that control space in the buildings, like the Senate or the House or the Department of Administration or whatever in the Capitol area, to be able to allow their employees to use space for health and wellness activities, including if they so choose to pay an instructor to conduct those activities.
Any discussions on this bill?
And the reason why the bill is here is because it deals with a release of liability,
yes,
for anything that happens during those activities. And that was one of the major concerns about allowing it, that whether there would be any exposure of the entity if someone was hurt.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
This is not directly germane to what we're talking here, but I'm deeply concerned about the way that employee health coverage is, that you get these letters and things that spend state's money because they go through the state office that's managing that. But the fact is that it's like this survey that you completed at the start, and you could get an additional deduction if you sent this computerized thing yet. Today I get another mailing that indicates that they're going to be doing some of these health things. And by the time I see that come, why, it's just a waste of our money, and I guess I'd like to...
formally register it in the committee. So for people who are listening, who are doing this work, you need to come and see Senator Foley. Ms. Pontius, the indemnification language that's in this section, is this adequate to serve the purpose that Senator Ress would like it to be? And it's a release of liability.
Madam basically. Chair and members, yes, I think it does. I mean, it doesn't actually provide any immunity, per se. It just makes it clear that the person who's conducting the activities would be liable, and to the extent the state was perhaps sued because an injury occurred on state property, that they'd be entitled to indemnification. So it's not actual immunity. But,
Senator Rest?
As I understand it, too, the Department of Administration signed off on the,
very good,
on the language. I got that secondhand, but I trust the source.
Okay. Any further discussions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, is there any supervision of this these programs so that the state doesn't...
Senator Rest?
Madam Chair, I don't know. I mean, this is going to be adults getting together to do
aerobics
or calisthenics, so or yoga. So I don't know what additional supervision would be needed. I mean, they may have someone leading a class in front of them. That would be up to them. They would have to obviously schedule the use of the, just like anybody else schedules the use of space in a building. So I'm sure those kinds of questions would be asked. How many people, what time, making sure it's time when it's not during work time, and or people take comp time in order to do it, et cetera.
Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 1464 be recommended to pass and be referred to the floor. Any further discussions on that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Say, Senator Rest, this is a really great bill. Many of my colleagues and friends who live outside of the Capitol have advised that given the level of stress and the 24-hour potential capacity around here, that many of us would be much healthier if we did something. So thank you for doing this.
Walk in the tunnel.
I don't have stress.
He causes it. He doesn't have stress.
Carrier.
He causes it.
Yeah, every time we get on the floor and Senator Limmer stands up and holds his microphone, I think, the blood pressure level all goes up a notch in the back of the retirement
Madam Chair,
room.
You know, as you know, a nurse comes in every Monday morning to monitor the blood pressure. As I recall, we didn't bring him in until Senator Limmer showed up.
I suppose you're going to blame the defibrillator thing on me, too.
Let's take up Senator Kubley's bill. Senator Kubley. Members, you may recall that Senator Kubley brought to us a Rural Health Cooperative Arrangements bill, and we worked with him on trying to get some language work out. Ms. Pontius and Senator Kubley and the individuals involved in this have been in conversation. And so Senator Kubley has asked us to bring the bill back. I don't see a need to take a lot of testimony. I think that at the time there was a lot of information that was kind of thrown at us at once, and we just needed to slow down the process a little bit to make sure that everyone was on the same page and have had an opportunity to review all the information. I've personally met with Senator Kubley and the individuals who are involved in this issue, and I'm satisfied that Senator Kubley has been very responsive in responding to some of the concerns. So we are giving Senator Kubley an opportunity to bring this back so that we could make a decision for him. Senator Kubley, welcome back to the committee.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. There is also an amendment that reflects some of the things that we talked about in your office, Senator Moore. you know, I don't know what your preference is, if you want to take up those amendments for the amendment first. Or
yes, yes.
Maybe Ms. Pontius could explain the amendment for the committee a little bit.
Do that. Ms. Pontius, how many amendments? One or two? Just one?
Just one.
Just one.
And Madam Chair and members, this is the A3 amendment. It's drafted as a delete everything, but I can just kind of highlight what the changes are. Basically, after reviewing the letter from the FTC and particular things they pointed out in this legislation that were problematic, probably the biggest issue that was raised was the fact that under the original language in the bill, if the Commissioner of Health fails to act, that an application is deemed approved. So there, it doesn't, in a sense, require an affirmative approval. So what this language does, if you look on the amendment, starting with online 1.115, and go down, it actually requires the commissioner to either approve or deny an application within 60 days, whereas the original bill language said if the commissioner doesn't act within 60 days, it's deemed approved. So this would require an affirmative action on the part of the Commissioner of Health one way or the other.
Madam Chair?
Senator Betzel.
Is there more than one page? Because at the bottom of page two, it seems to end in mid-sentence. So there should be. I don't know if we got the full thing
That's
here.
That's what it is.
Madam Chair, it looks like this was copied at the last minute this morning. We might have lost the last page.
Yeah, we don't need to know.
Well, I'll take your word for it, I guess.
We can go get the last page copy.
There are a couple of other lines on the committee engrossment, Madam Chair and Senator Betzel. We're working off the committee engrossment,
no.
Isn't that correct? I noticed the one in the file over here is not the committee endorsement.
So, Senator Betzel, if you look at the committee endorsement, the two lines that are missing are lines 3.19 and 3.20.
Okay.
Those are the only lines that are missing.
Members, I can tell you, it's just a few lines that are missing.
I see. Okay.
So, Ms. Pontius, why don't you walk us through, and then when we get over there, we can make the reference to the two missing lines, and then maybe by then Mr. Backus will be back. With the two missing lines.
Okay. And then, Madam Chair, members, the other thing, and this kind of relates to the missing lines, is there's also language in here that requires the commissioner to not only review the initial contracts, but if you look on page 1, line 11, the commissioner would also be reviewing any modification, renewal, or extension of a contract that was previously approved. So there would be kind of an ongoing review rather than just a one-time upfront approval of an arrangement.
And that's a change that is not on the amendment. Is that right, Ms. Pontius?
Ms. Pontius?
Senator Kuby, that's in the amendment. That's also, that was actually there's some additional fee language that relates to that, which is what's missing on the third page.
Okay. And Ms. Pontius, the delete everything amendment incorporates any changes that the committee made to the first engrossment in the last, when the bill was before us. I see, for example, that the intent and purpose language that was on the first engrossment is not on the delete everything.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. Took out the purpose language and then clarified that this is the Commissioner of Health. So all those amendments that the committee already did
are incorporated into the
delete everything.
Okay. Any questions or any questions for Senator Cooperly or Ms. Pontius on the A3 amendment? Senator Olson moves the A3 amendment. Any further discussions? On the A3 amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Now, I'm assuming that if there's no discussions on the A3 amendment, no further discussions on Senate File 203 as amended. Senator Olson moves Senate File 203 as amended be recommended to pass. And I think it doesn't have anywhere else to go.
Finance.
It goes to finance. Yes. And be referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Kuby, and thank you for working hard on this.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Appreciate your work.
Senator Olson, are you finished upstairs?
No. Madam Chair, no, I was just third in line, so I came back down.
Okay, well let's take 863.
Madam Chair, Senate File 863 is the Omnibus Data Practices Bill vehicle. As at least four of us on this committee know, we've spent two lengthy committee meetings going through the provisions in this bill in the Data Practices Subcommittee, and there are a substantial number of provisions in the bill this year, and I'll just quickly walk through what those provisions are.
Senator Olson, let me clarify with the committee members. Usually when time permits, we do a subcommittee report, and we bring the subcommittee report to the committee as a recommendation for your approval. That way we don't have to, I mean, the subcommittee recommendation will generally govern how the, well, I mean, the whole committee doesn't always have to take what they say, but a lot of work has been done in the subcommittee. But because we're tight for time, instead of trying to get it processed as a subcommittee report, we just brought all the work that has been done and voted on in the subcommittee as the A11, delete everything amendment that you have in front of you. So the A11 amendment was a document that we worked off of, and that will then take into consideration the language of 863 as well as other data practices provisions that were considered in the subcommittee. And I believe that the A11 represents all the work that was incorporate into the document with recommendations for inclusion in the Omnibus Data Practices Bill. So this is really a report of the recommendation to pass from the Data Practices Subcommittee to the full committee. It's just that our process is making it into a delete everything amendment. And now Senator Olson will briefly walk us through the different provisions that are in here. But it is coming to the full committee with recommendation from the subcommittee. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I'll try to be brief. Section 1 of the A11 amendment strikes language dealing with informed consent requirements for the release of data for insurance purposes. Section 2 rewrites those informed consent requirements for insurance purposes. Section 3 authorizes government entities to share data that are not public with insurance carriers under very specific circumstances and limits the sharing of that data. Section 4 is really technical, correcting some terminology relating to public meetings. Section 5... again, I think is really technical. Article 2, moving on to your summary of, on the second page, provides that data in a temporary classification is deemed to be classified upon request of the commissioner. This was Senator Betzold's bill and at the request of the department. Section 2 modifies the provisions governing the Section 2 modifies the provisions governing the contents of applications for non-public or protected non-public data to include all not public data. Section 3 amends the procedure applicable when a classification affects other government entities. Section 4 provides for withdrawal of an application for a temporary classification under certain circumstances. Section 5 amends timelines governing the commissioner's determination, determinations on classifications. Section 6 authorizes a responsible authority to request approval for a new or different use of data, data subject to temporary classification. And Section 7 modifies the expiration date of temporary classifications. And basically, those were all aspects of that Senator Betzold bill. Article 3 deals with personnel data, Section 1 amends the definition of personnel data to refer to government data on individuals maintained rather than using the word collected. Section 2 makes the terms and conditions of employment public data. We had considerable discussion about this issue, including related to email address And then there's at some point also, I think, in another section related to, I can't remember if it was this one or another one, related to how much of a person's income would be public if they're...
Top of page 9. Same section.
So we did have quite a bit of discussion about that and decided that basically to uphold a decision that was reached that says if you're a public employee, your public financial information is available to the public, but your private financial information for non-public work would be private. And that's basically what's reflected in the decision that we made. The balance of these, I don't think were really substantive in terms of Article 3. Article 4, miscellaneous provisions. Section 1 classifies certain research monitoring or assessment data of the Department of Agriculture as private or non-public, and basically what that related to was research they wanted to do, and they wanted to keep identifying information of farmers and people who would participate in their questionnaires from being available publicly. So the results and the aggregate non-identifying information would be available, but not the specific private information. Section 2 is a cross-reference, really technical. Section 3 provides that parole and county probation authorities have access to specific data on firearm permit applicant or permit holders. We didn't have anyone testify that they had any opposition to that provision. Section 4 classifies certain licensing data of the Department of Natural Resources as private. We had a lengthy conversation about this section, both in the Environmental Policy Committee and in data practices. And without going into the whole history, the upshot basically is that if someone now gives, applies for a fishing license, gets a permit to, for a, whether it's a motor vehicle, a gun, anything that's within the Department of Natural Resources jurisdiction, that information will be private to everyone, unless it's a government like law enforcement or a government purpose with a need to know, or unless the person specifically gives their consent to make the information public. And that actually is a bit of a change in existing law, but seemed to very much to be the will of the committees that considered this. Section 5 amends the tax data statute to authorize the disclosure of certain tax return information in cases involving harassment of Department of Revenue employees. This was at the request of the department. Section 6 amends the data practices provisions applicable to Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board. The investigation reports would be private data or non-public data unless the board finds there was negligence or misconduct. And Section 7 delays the effective date of the business screening service law. This was something we spent a lot of time on last year. There are still some issues to be potentially worked out, and we're hoping that those will be worked out so that we can actually implement an earlier date. In fact, Senator Betzold's, again, this was Senator Betzold's bill, and maybe he'll decide to do that anyway, but we're hoping to resolve some of those differences first.
Senator Olson, let me interrupt you a little bit. On the Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board, Council has drafted an A-12 technical amendment to do a cross-reference. And the A-12, you should have the A-12 in your packets.
Yes, we do.
Ms. Pontius, could you talk to the A-12 amendment?
Madam Chair, members, this is just whenever there's a data classification outside of Chapter 13, there are sections in Chapter 13 that just include cross-references. And that was omitted as part of Senator Orman's language. So this just adds a Chapter 13 cross-reference to the classification.
Senator Lemmer? You okay with this?
Yes.
Senator Lemmer moves the A-12 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Okay. Sorry. Please continue.
Madam Chair, that concludes Senator my Betzel. Summary of the bill.
Right. Thank you, Senator Olson. I believe she was finished. Madam Chair, let me just comment on the last item that Senator Olson mentioned, and that was the business screening records. We did spend a lot of time, well, the last 2 years, actually, on that, and the law that is ready to go into effect in July puts some requirements on organizations that collect data on individuals. It's public information that they collect, and then they provide it to people who need the data. Now, sometimes the information is wrong. Either it was correctly, they copied it right, but it was wrong in the first instance, or maybe they messed it up and it just got wrong somehow in the database. And I think in this data of electronic data, we want to make sure that you can never pull it back and retrieve it, but there is a duty to correct the data. Now, that we've passed that law. It is ready to go into effect. Now, just like any other major legislation, sometimes you find issues that, you know, sometimes they're fairly minor, sometimes they're fairly significant. But the other night, there were, frankly, a lot of folks that wanted to spend a whole lot of time arguing all over the map on the bill or the law. So I did have a bill that was on the agenda. What I proposed to do, which really cut the discussion short, was simply to extend the effective date from July 1st of 2009 to July 1st of 2010. That having been said, Madam Chair, you know, I would hope that if I can get some resolution to some of these issues within the next week or so, we could probably put that bill back on the Judiciary Committee agenda or the Data Practices agenda, however we do it, adopt whatever changes that need to be made. And if the bill leaves committee, of course, it's just going to go to the Rules Committee because it's a late bill. But we will at least have our committee position so that when this bill is taken up on the floor, we may have be able to have an amendment to offer to the bill to incorporate those changes. So that's, you know, that's where I would hope that we can do it over the next couple of days. So that's the plan that I have on that one. So, and Madam Chair, if I could just go back and visit, and when Senator Olson mentioned the electronic licensing, that, you know, for the non-commercial game and fish licensing, cross-country ski pass, horse trail passes. This is something we should make sure people are aware of, that there are groups or organizations that buy a lot of these lists, and there are people that don't realize that people buy these lists. Now, it's been an issue that's been bouncing around my whole time here. When the driver's license data used to be public, and we had long discussions, should be public or not. Well, the federal government solved that one. But we may be hearing, at, you know, down the road, some groups and organizations that may have some issues because they like to buy these lists. So we should just be aware that, you know, that there was a lot of discussion, I guess, when Senator Olson brought this bill to the Environment and Natural Resources Committee, a lot of discussion, Data Practices Subcommittee. So it is a change, and but we should be aware of what it says.
That's fine. All right. So any further discussions on the
Madam
A11?
Chair?
Senator Lemire.
Madam Chair, I wanted to go back to page 8. And I am on line 6 of page 8. There's a reference to a responsible authority, and I was wondering, who would that responsible authority be?
Which page?
Page 8.
Page 8, line 6.
Line 6.
Ms. Pontius? Ms. Pontius is looking at the other invisible sections. Is that not? Ms. Bar-Kropinski?
Madam Chair and members, Lori Bar-Kropinski, Department of Administration. The reference at line 8.6, the temporary classification process is available to any government entity, and a government entity is a state agency, a political subdivision. So it would depend on who asked for the temporary classifications, whoever it is, that responsible authority would be able to then ask for a new use of data. So it depends on who asked for the TC in the first place.
Okay. Madam Chair, on the same page going to line 18, the word collected versus maintained. Mr. Gemberling at the Data Privacy Committee kind of gave us a little warning of verbs are very important if this ever went to a court challenge. And I just wanted to revisit, is this the
the proper verb that we should be putting into this statute.
Ms. Barr-Kopinski.
Madam Chair and members, in using the word maintained, we used a word that was the broadest that you could use, but also in addition, we added government in front of data to make it crystal clear. Government data is already defined to mean collected, created, disseminated, maintained. So all of the data possible for that a government might have is included within this definition.
All right. Also, Madam Chair, on page 9, a concern that Senator Betzold attempted to address was the employer-paid portion that's added for remuneration. For lack of a better inclusion, I will support this, but I wanted to just ask the question, what if the employee was paid on a second job or a second contract of some sort, but was doing work that was a conflict of interest with the work that he does with the state? That isn't quite addressed in this provision of law, and so I don't have the cure for that, but I'm wondering if somewhere down the line we should visit that so that at least if there is a conflict of law, it would be the responsibility of the employee to either step back or to I don't know what you do in that, because we wouldn't have any means to know or react to that or disclose that.
Ms. Barr-Kopinski.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, many government entities have policies around what kind of outside work and what kind of conflicts of interest people can have and how that process is going to work. And if someone were to violate one of those, I would assume that the government entity would seek discipline against the employee, and that would be how it would be addressed. And when the discipline was final, then all of that data would then be public. So if a government entity found a conflict and disciplined an employee, eventually that data would be public. For state employees, there is a statutory section that provides that we can't have conflicts of interest. So for state employees as well, if we were to be disciplined for violating that law, then eventually that data would be public.
Madam Chair, I don't know if disclosure is the proper term, because if you're working in a conflict of interest, most likely the individual would not want to disclose that. And if they did disclose it, then it defeats the purpose of being hired in the first place. But if certain departments or agencies have policies of that, then I'm just wondering if it isn't cross-referenced in statute somewhere. And that's the only I'm just raising it for discussion purposes right now for perhaps a later visit sometime. But I'm not sure if we cover the full gambit of what could occur. And I understand and certainly sympathetic with protecting an element of privacy when it comes to employees of the state making other income, especially in these times. And so for lack of a cure right now, I think we should just keep the discussion going, and maybe something will surface later on.
Senator Limerick, would you be willing to stay in communication with Ms. Barr-Kopinski and others involved in this and maybe come back and brief the committee members on this issue? Thanks.
Sure.
All right. Senator Olson moves that the moves the A11 amendment as amended.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Senator Lummer.
I'm sorry to interrupt. There's one more question on page 13, line 17, where the board would find that there would be negligence or misconduct of a use of a report. Are we just limiting this? Reaction just to a board, or are we relying on the board to be the one that governs this, would there be discipline that would occur from this? What happens if the board, is it just limited to a board, or is there a larger agency that could have authority in the event that there would be negligence or misconduct?
Ms. Barr-Kopinski.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, the board that this language references is the Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board, and I'm not sure how functional that is. It was a Senator Ortman bill. As far as then, it just deals with the classification of the data that board would maintain about these investigations.
All right. And the other question is
in
the event that there was an investigation for negligence or misconduct,
just the aggregate data of that, if there was, let's say, two investigations of negligence or misconduct, would anyone ever know at least the aggregate data that, oh, two occurrences happened in 2006? But if there was a consistent record of two a year, three a year, 10 a year, would anyone outside of this board ever know that there was perhaps a continual problem in their agency?
Spark Kopinski.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, summary data, which is data that is stripped of identifiers, is always public. So there would still be an ability to release, you know, kind of statistical and summary information that isn't identifying under existing law. So I think that people would still be able to know some information about what kinds of complaints, the numbers, things like that.
See, Madam Chair, would that you said it would be available. Would that mean that someone would have to ask for that? Or would there be a report ongoing that would be available on internet or something?
Ms. Barkopinski.
Madam Chair and members, I'm not sure whether or not this board has any reporting requirements, but typically if data is public, you are only responsive to requests that you receive. But certainly if the board wanted to push data out, they certainly could.
All right.
Any other questions, Senator Limmer?
Nope, I'm done.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, why do we continue to kind of indicate that we've got some kind of care in the data privacy area when, as a matter of fact, that doesn't exist at all since the computerization and the data harvesting and all of that? And we've got Senator Latz coming in on an issue on expungement. What you end up with is a whole series of people that their data isn't private at all, and they're ending up in where they have housing problems and job problems and all of that because of things that we've done. And I really think, Madam Chair, that you should be looking to develop some kind of task force, study committee or something to deal with the answer, because we can't continue to go on and say we've got all of these things when we really don't.
And we may be moving in that direction, Senator Foley, but this committee cares about if we're going to say we're going to classify data as private, I think that we're the committee cares that we ought to stay true to that. And so to the degree that we could continue to send that signal, we want to do that. Senator Betzel moves
there. Senator Betzel? Chair, we have visited those issues a lot over the years. About 10 years ago, we had a task force because we were starting to worry about electronic records and so forth. And clearly the days when government data was in a manila folder in a file cabinet and you'd have to go down to the government center and stand at the counter and, you know, photocopy, those days are gone. But still, government is unique because government alone can force people to disclose information about themselves. And if it comes in the hands of government, we've made a public policy, a policy that it's all public, unless we categorize it in some way. And we have to not only decide how to categorize it, but who gets it, even within government agencies. Those principles still hold true, even if it's on electronic format. It's just easier. But we're in an age right now where people want and expect more and more information about everything. At the same time, they want more and more privacy about themselves. And I don't know how to balance those. But those are the challenges.
Right. Senator Betts moves the A11 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Then Senator Betts moves as a co-author, Senate Betzel moves Senate File 863 as amended be recommended to pass. Any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Members, Senate File 1231, which was Senator Ortman's bill, which is now Senator Latz's bill. Senator Ortman asked us to put it on the agenda, and then Senator Ortman asked us on behalf of Senator Latz to now take it off the agenda. Oh. So we're not going to be doing that.
That's easy.
Chair, it's also the bill that I moved last night.
Yes, which was for little itty-bitty time Senator Shide's amendment. And then I don't know if the language for Senate File 565 is here yet. It is? All right.
We're in trouble again. So.
A lot of trust going on here.
We're on 565? 565, yeah, the last bill. I know why she gave you the demo.
Senator Ma, were you going to present?
Yes.
All right. Proceed, Senator Ma.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the A9 amendment is was a bill that we... The A9 amendment is a delete everything amendment to Senate File 565. Again, this was a bill that was heard in the Data Practices Subcommittee. There was a split decision on whether or not we would recommend this bill out. I think that the chair of the subdivision very wisely indicated that from a data perspective, we have, there was joint concern from both Senator Olson and Senator Lemmer about particularly the University of Minnesota provision, and that the Data Practice Subcommittee did not have a plurality in recommending that language from a data perspective. So I made the decision to move Senate File 565 forward to the full committee for our consideration. And I would ask that you to be respectful to the decision that was made in the Data Practice Subcommittee. I would ask that we move Senate File 565, which is the A9 amendment, to the Higher Ed Committee without recommendation, because the Higher Ed Committee has a deep interest in these in these two provisions. They involve policies at the University of Minnesota. And I think that by sending this to them without recommendation on the data provision, we would like them to take note that we have some concerns about the data provisions. But certainly, being the Higher Education Committee with prerogative over the University of Minnesota, they have a say in whether or not this moves forward. So I would move the A9 amendment, which is the language that the Data Practice Subcommittee reviewed. Again, this would have been a subcommittee report, but because of time constraint, we did it as delete everything amendment to Senate File 565. Also included in this, members, is the language from Senator Pappas's Senate File 661, which is the, a larger bill, but we took just the data provisions from that bill, and we sent her jackets onto her, and we held on to the data provisions. And so that data provision was considered in the Data Practice Subcommittee, was amended to Senate File 565. So you have the entire document before you. I move the A9 amendment.
The A9 amendment is before us. Any further questions or discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Higgins.
Senator Shide and I are noticing shalls being changed to must.
On page two.
All over page two.
Who did that?
And we're wondering, has there been a change that we don't know about? Then is the terminology changing to must? But holy cow, there's a million of them in here.
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, my understanding from Senator Pappas is that this language came to us, I believe, from the university. And so they, I don't, do you guys have any information on this section? Ms. Pontius has.
Madam Chair, it really is style. I mean, the move has been away from using the word shall except in limited circumstances. So usually it's only used, you know, when you have an affirmative duty on, say, that like the commissioner shall do something, like a person shall do something. And must, like the list must include, it's like a requirement of the list, but it's not requiring the list to take some action. So though I think those are stylistic changes that were made by the revisor's office. When sometimes when they get language in front of them, they'll try to get rid of some of those shells and change them to must, but it's not substantive. Yeah.
And then we change all the must to shalls, and then they have to revert them back.
Of course. Now, Madam, or Senator Moab, just in a previous bill, Senator Betzel came up and wanted to make sure that the musts were gone and the shall would be in place. And thinking that recognizing it more as a kind of a current stylistic standard, And is must mean something more in the direction than shall? I mean, after all, we're not recommending a pass on this bill, but we're now, it seems to me like we're revving up the language a little bit more.
Senator Lemire, I can't answer that. Other than, I think, stylistically, maybe the shall is if it's within the authority of, say, a commissioner to do something, versus if we tell them that they must do something.
Yeah.
So if it's within their authority and they shall do something within their authority, but if we are telling them, then we put in a must.
No, we put in a must.
Right? And I guess, that's not the case?
Madam Chair, then you use a may.
They will use a may.
No, I think must and shall mean the same thing. They're both mandatory now. Stylistically, you'll see bills sometimes even now that'll say the commissioner must do something.
Mm-hmm. Our work is very close to being done when we're debating shalls and must.
The light at the end of the tunnel is coming.
Mr. Chair, I renew my motion on the A9 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
They ought to,
Sarah Foley.
They ought to process.
I was going to talk to Madam Foley. Chair, but you're not Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, it's interesting that the very last sentence of the entire bill is the university is requested to comply. that's a real backtrack if you want to ask me about it. They're all over the second page. Yes, must.
That's constitutional.
Well, we do have to recognize the humility of the legislature when we're dealing with the university.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Foley.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Mao, why do we have all of this financial proprietary and other kinds of information?
That's a good question.
I would assume that allows the university to do investments, but I wonder why. Has somebody here telling me why that's in it?
Senator Foley, the university is here, but let me just very succinctly summarize. And this is it's one of those things where you're either comfortable with what they're asking us to allow them to do or not. I mean, I don't think there's anything in between, because we've really talked about this very thoroughly in the data practice subcommittee, and I have tremendous respect for Senator Limmer and Senator Olson's level of discomfort. The university... in the past have been able to participate in some joint venture opportunities, but because the university is a public institution subject to the Freedom of Information Act, people can request information from the university about its investments. And so imagine if the university is one of five participants in a project. The other four are private entities, and the university is public. If somebody wanted information about that particular project, they don't have access through the other four, but they would come through the university to get information about that particular project. And what's happening is that the University of Minnesota has been uninvited, has been asked to not participate by some of the bigger entities that we've been able to do work with in the past. And so the university has come to us to say, look, we're not asking you to allow us to, make everything secret. We're just asking us to allow us to not reveal some things about the activities that we're participating in. The name of the general partners, the name of the entities, a summary of the funds, a summary of, how much the losses or the gains, that will be available. But we just want to not have to be put in a position where we are giving information that could jeopardize or could be used by competitors, which makes us then unattractive as a participant in this effort. So that's the gist of what it is that they're trying to do. Although, and it's not visible in the bill, the regents and the investment committee of the regents have access to this information. And it's not clear whether or not that process, is open to public debate. My assumption is that when they're talking about the investments with the investment committee, that's probably a subcommittee meeting that may be closed. And I think that, we'll have a separate conversation at some point, and I think Senator Limmer is interested in having that conversation. But the regents, get all the information. And the investment committee at the regents, have to approve the projects that the university participates in. So it isn't as if there's one person somewhere making all the decision, but, the regents that we appoint are involved in some of that decision making. And I know Senator Limmer have raised this, that, you know, that's, for him, that doesn't rise high enough to a level of oversight. And I respect that. So that's why when we had the discussion, it was, I mean, it was 2 days of discussion that was pretty long. And at the end of the day, you know, the balance is, do you, if you're uncomfortable with this, then you want the university to have all the information available. If you're not, if you're comfortable with the fact that we could limit the access that might help them to have some investment opportunities, then we should go forward. And I think that the Data Practice Subcommittee was torn on that. So that's why, out of respect for Senator Olson and Limmer, I'm moving this forward without recommendation from us.
Thank you.
Sir Foley.
Madam Chair, Senator Mao, I was just looking for an explanation
yes.
why their investment portfolio was on the table.
Yes.
Senator Foley, just to characterize my interest in this bill is it's true that Senator Moi and I and other members of the Data Privacy Committee had not heated discussion, but good, vibrant policy discussion regarding how far do we go in trying to recognize the openness of government versus a request by the university to keep certain investment records sealed for their business purpose. It would satisfy a concern of one of their investment partners to keep certain data close to the vest and not reveal it for public purpose. I disagree with that that policy. I believe things that when we invest public money, we should have an open book as far as in relationship to the way we do it on other investments in the state of Minnesota. They've asked for an exception to a few elements of that policy. A few years ago, the university was placed under the authority of Chapter 13, which is our data privacy records. This is a request for an exception to not reveal specific investment information. The testimony revealed that they have rather lucrative investment strategies that they would not want to have in certain other investor hands at this time, which would perhaps weaken that investment.
Mr. Chair, when you look at that, are there other units? It seems to me like there are other units of government, like the pension funds, for instance, that are investing money that probably aren't revealing the same data as the university is?
Well, Senator Foley, as I understand it, Chapter 11A is the kind of the rules for investments by the State Investment Board.
Board, yeah.
Yes.
And those are the rules that they make their decisions and what is revealed and what is not revealed. And in this case, it's not exactly the same what the university is requesting. And I would need counsel or someone else to explain it. I've kind of pushed it away from me for now.
Mr. Chair and Senator Foley,
I'll bring it back later.
The investment board came to the legislature for some authority to also address some of the information that they to keep private some investment data that they can't reveal. The authority that the University of Minnesota is seeking, though, is somewhat different in that we're involved in a category of investments that the investment board does not participate in. So that's the only difference, is that we've given authority to other investment types entities to limit or to keep private certain types of data. But that's where the similarity ends. We don't exactly give this authority to the investment board, because the investment board doesn't need it, because they don't make this type of investments.
Thank you.
Senator Foley, one other concern that I had was we've been explained the reason why the university wishes to have this for this time in a particular
investor situation. My concern is with this language, they may have other investment partners in the future that may trigger a more deeper policy question in the future that we may never know about. And they may invest in some venture that may raise a lot of eyebrows and we should have a discussion on. And I'm afraid this may give cover for that. And the public nor the legislature would know what they invest their money in the future. And this is a rather broad policy direction, and I'm concerned about that.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you, and I renew my motion on the A9 amendment.
Yeah, Senator Moi moves the A9 amendment. Is there anyone else here in the room that wishes to speak for or against this issue? Hearing none, all in favor of the A9 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed, say no. No. Amendment passes.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 863 as amended, Senate File 565 as amended, be sent to the Higher Education Committee without recommendation from the Judiciary Committee.
Any further discussion on Senate File 565 as amended? Anyone in the audience that wishes to speak about the greater bill? Hearing none, all those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? No. Senate File 565 motion passes.
Yep.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
before you adjourn us, Mr. Chair, Mr. Backus has a clarifying question to ask us about the committee bill.
All right. Mr. Backus.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just wanted to make sure the members would be comfortable with this. I don't know if you remember, but last night there was an amendment that would amend the Chapter 645 provision that makes the prohibited conduct makes it a misdemeanor, and the amendment would have made it a petty. So that went on. But I would think to be consistent with the other changes in the bill, you would want to apply that amendment to first-time offenses similar to the other one. So if I wasn't exactly sure if I had the authority to do that, but if you're comfortable, I'll make that change in the bill.
First time.
Mr. Chair, and I think that was the consensus of the conversation and the amendment that came from the other side of the table.
Right, that's correct.
Do we need to vote on that, Senator Moi?
Okay.
Or Mr. Not? Chair, I don't think so.
All right. Hearing no other business at the desk, the Senate Judiciary Committee is adjourned.